Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. We talk frequently on this program about the divides in our country. We are divided politically, perhaps more so than we've seen since the Civil War. But systemic divisions in our country are more troubling. The division between those with access to opportunity, education, health care, and justice, and those denied these basic human rights. Throughout our nation's history, different groups have been singled out for exclusion. People of color, Jews, Muslims, women, members of the LGBTQ community, to name a few. Often fear, misunderstanding, and insecurity precedes exclusion. Why do we fear those we see as others? Are these fears learned or inherent to human nature? How are leaders using fear, bigotry, and hatred to promote political agendas? And where do we go from here? Helping us to sort through all of this is Peter Rose. He's Sophia Smith Professor Emeritus and Senior Fellow of the Kahn Institute at Smith College. He's also a visiting scholar at the Institute for Research in the Social Sciences at Stanford University. His new book, published this month, is titled Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mindy. It's good to talk to you again.
You've been teaching, lecturing, and writing about intolerance and bigotry for decades. It's important work, but it must also be a little bit wearisome revisiting these same issues over and over. What prompted you to write this latest book?
I think that the slippage that we've seen in the last 5 years is a frightening reality. I think that we were making pretty good progress. So there are peaks and valleys, of course, for years and years. We look at the 30s when I was a little kid and the nativism that was so widespread. We look at McCarthyism. But we also look at the 60s and the progress that was made. We look at the fact that Obama was elected as a sign of real progress. And then I think that this new era of Trump has set us back tremendously. And you open by saying something about divided America, and as you know, I end the last section of the book is called The Divided States of America. And maybe I should have called it The Divided State of America, because that's what I think we are right now. We're two separate, almost two separate worlds. If we see the demonstrations that are going on as we speak in Washington, it's very frustrating. It's very troubling. It's very frightening. On the other hand, what's going on in Georgia with Warnock getting elected last night and the chance that Ossoff may make it is a hopeful sign, I think.
Tell us more about your father-in-law to whom you dedicate the book.
My father-in-law was a pastry chef on the Holland-America line. He was a Sephardic Jew whose family was in Amsterdam, as far as we know, from about the 16th century. We've traced it back to the late 17th century in the Netherlands. He was picked up several times by the Nazis in 1941, and as I say in the dedication, he was arrested, sent to the East, the euphemism, first to Westerbork, and then to Auschwitz, where he died. The records are very clear. The Nazis were very efficient. We know when he died, where he died. And a man, of course, I never knew. But he was my father-in-law.
In the introduction, you write, quote, "This book is a short course on xenophobic racism and populist nationalism, which are enduring threats to the social fabric of democratic societies." Would you define the terms xenophobic racism and populist nationalism for us?
Yes, well, the populist nationalism is really an appeal to people who are ordinary people, if you will, who feel somehow that they are being had. I talk about later on the once-hads, and it's Seymour Martin Lipset used that phrase in a book, and I think it's a very apt one. It's people who feel that somehow something's being taken away from them, and such people are very vulnerable to the appeals of those who can stress the kind of bigotry that we've seen, the demagoguery. What was the other thing that you asked about?
Xenophobic racism.
The nationalism, I'm sorry.
And populist nationalism, yeah.
Yeah. It refers really to the general public, the appeal to so many people who feel that they are being had. I refer to the once heads, but there's also the never heads, the people who say, if it weren't for those so-and-sos, I would be there. Right. And that gets into the whole politics of race, that affirmative action, for example, which I talk about, is seen and exploited by those who want to stress this populist, who emphasize the fact that they're not getting it. It's those minorities that are getting it, those undeserving poor who are getting it, and so forth, at our expense.
So we see xenophobic racism and populist nationalism throughout the world. It's not just an issue in the United States. Do you believe fear of other is inherent in human nature?
No. But I do believe, I don't think it's inherent, if you mean if there's an innate aversion to others. Mm. But I do think that there is a maybe you could call it a sinister proclivity for people to separate themselves from others. It enhances their own egos. It makes them feel stronger. It makes them feel more important. I cite in the book a study that was done in the 1930s by a guy named John Dollard, in which he talks about, you can say it was a Marxist view, that the economic exploitation enhances the people who are in power. You can say it's political, but it's also psychological. The one thing that he showed, and we see over and over again, is that there is somebody else that you can blame. The one thing that even the poorest whites in the South had when he studied caste and class in a southern town was they weren't black. And that makes a big difference, and that's played upon by bigots and people who exploit fear.
Darwin's theory of evolution is based on the idea of survival of the fittest, and certainly there are instances of cooperative societies, but competition for resources is often at the root of conflict. So if we pare down fear to its most basic level, is it about survival?
I think in a way it is, but I think that there's a kind of, it was Spencer who talked about the survival of the fittest. And I think what one of the problems is that the people don't really believe it. They worry that the fittest will not survive, and they have to do something about it. There's a whole section in the book in which I talk about eugenics, which is really based upon that notion. I mean, it goes way back to Galton and others, but those who were the social Darwinists, I think, were very concerned that the fittest would not survive, and they had to act. And social engineering is one way you can do it. You can keep people out of the country. You can put in methods of birth control to control the fecundity of a population that's already there. And all these things were done, indeed, in our own history.
In the book, you talk about the concepts of pride and prejudice. So is it possible to have pride without prejudice?
I think so. I think that one can be proud in a very broad sense. I think that I use it in the sense of juxtaposing the kind of chauvinism, pride in that sense, where it's an exaggerated pride in yourself, in your country, and in the nation. But no, I do believe that it's possible to have an even broader view of humanity. But then I'm an eternal optimist on that. Although my will has been somewhat shaken recently.
Yeah, talk a little bit about how does prejudice or discrimination take root?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. They're two different concepts, I think. Mm-hmm. Even though they play into each other, you know, one can have prejudice and not discriminate when law prevents you from doing it, for example. Discrimination is an action. It can be verbal. That can be discrimination. But I think it gets back to what I said earlier, that I think that it is the dichotomy that I've been concerned about most of my adult life between they and we, between ourselves and others, and then exploiting that is how it really begins. I don't think that we are innately, it's not innate aversions. You have to be taught to hate, but we are very often. We're taught all kinds of things. We're taught what to like and what to dislike, who's nice and who's not, and so forth. And that's really the beginning of this.
Yeah, I guess, and I'm thinking, you know, that being human nature, I'm wondering, you know, just thinking about, you know, tribes, you know, when we go back just in history, and we all belong to some sort of tribe, right? And so if you're not part of that tribe, you're other, right? Yeah,
so that's I think that's very true, and I think there's been a kind of retribalization. One of the problems that I think we've had in this country, and maybe we're seeing it in Georgia change somewhat, is that we have been tribalized or siloed or something by ethnicity. It's our strength in many ways, but we don't very often go beyond it, so that we're very dependent on our own groups. And in the United States, ethnic groups are very critical. But it's interesting that there hasn't really been a successful movement, workers' movement, for example, that would transcend ethnicity to say we're all in the same cotton field, if you will, and we've got to act together. I think that this is one of the appeals, as I say, of Ossoff and Warnock in Georgia. We're beginning to see that black and white people working very hard together for a common good. But I worry about what Harold Isaacs once called the retribalization, and I see it too. And the rivalry is a generator of all kinds of things, and tribal rivalry, of course, is one of them.
Right. The phrase "words matter" might sound cliched, but when groups are singled out, given labels or nicknames, it's the first step toward discrimination, right? So give us some examples of that.
Well, I think that it's a stepped process. You label someone, you generalize, you stereotype, then you stigmatize. And then you act according to the stigma. If the person, my wife, for example, as a child, had to wear a yellow star before her father was taken, and she went into hiding. Why? Because they couldn't tell who the Jews were from others, so they slapped a label on them, and then people shied away from them because they were so labeled.
We're talking with Peter Rose. His new book is Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Peter Rose, Sophia Smith Professor Emeritus and Senior Fellow of the Kahn Institute at Smith College. He's also a visiting scholar at the Institute for Research in the Social Sciences at Stanford University. His new book out this month is Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Peter, we value free speech in our country, but it can be a double-edged sword. We're talking about, you know, words matter. Where have we succeeded and where have we failed as we navigate this line between what is acceptable and unacceptable language?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that question, because you're really asking what are the limits of tolerance, I think. And I think that we have protected speech in this country that is very important. It is very extensive, and so that we can say pretty much what we want and very often get away with murder. In other countries, there are more restrictions, but it's a trade-off, I think. So I don't really know how to answer what the limits of tolerance are.
I understand what you're saying. You include a graphic titled "The Pyramid of White Supremacy." Describe that for us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that.
It's a sociologist devised this pyramid. It's a very graphic representation of the increasing intensity of discrimination, ranging from name calling all the way up to genocide. She shows this in a graphic pyramid with various stages. There's another one that I think is very interesting that ties back to what you asked about in terms of tribalism that I might mention. Yeah. It's not in this book, but I've talked about it elsewhere. Milton Gordon wrote about interactions at various levels, and he plays class against ethnicity, something that I alluded to before. And one of the very interesting things, it's also a pyramid in my mind, and that the higher up you go in the pyramid, the more you interact with other people and you have a greater sense of what other people are like, more educated people, more cosmopolitan people. And this is a very critical thing to understand, I think, that at the bottom of that pyramid are the tribes, and they are the most exploitable people at the bottom of that pyramid, which perhaps I should have put in that book as another book, but anyway.
Unfortunately, there are some who have a perverse pleasure in seeing the misfortune or suffering of others. Give us an example in this everyday life and why this can be so dangerous.
Well, I think we're seeing it now, and that is we're seeing it in the streets of Washington today, that if you, it's a kind of schadenfreude, that you get joy out of the exploitation of others because it builds up your ego and it makes you feel important. And and we're seeing that right now throughout, not only in this country, but throughout the world. And one of the things that's been very troubling is the extent to which what's happening here is happening in many other countries. In Europe, for example, in Hungary and in Poland, and they're using the same old scapegoating, blaming the victim, and acting in ways that they did in the 1930s that we're so familiar with.
That's scary, isn't it? Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Aside from indigenous people, our country is a nation of immigrants. And you sort of touched on this. Talk about how we identify different groups through nation of origin labels and why some labels persist over generations while others disappear.
Well, I think that there's a hierarchy of acceptability, which also leads to acceptance. We don't think, for example, of Rumsfeld or Eisenhower or even Trump as German-Americans. But if you say Cuomo, you immediately say, Italian-American. Even Kennedy, you say, well, Irish-American and so forth. And those people who are the sort of legacy of the early groups of the so-called Protestant establishment and so forth sort of blend in a little bit more than the others. And there's always been a kind of social distancing in our society. I mentioned the names of movie stars, for example, and the extent to which those people who we know by their stage names, which tend to be old English names and so forth, are in fact from many, many different places. But the template of acceptance was set a long time ago. It has changed in recent years. People don't change their names since Barbara Streisand and so forth, as much, or Paul Newman. But I think that is an indication of what sociologists call reference groups. How do you refer to yourself? What is the model? And that model is very often taught to us. These are the ideal folks and so forth.
Earlier you mentioned ethnicity, and help us understand the differences between race and ethnicity.
Well, ethnicity really means culture. There's a blurring very often of these terms, and I think they're very separate, although ethnicity is a very specific idea of people who share norms, values, and so forth, and a common heritage. The only similarity to race would be a common heritage, but if it's in its purest form, it would be a genetic, a composite of genetically transmissible physical traits. But there are very few pure races, if you will, in a country like ours. My colleague, Ruben Rumbaud, a Cuban-American, always refers to this as a pigment of the imagination, which is funny. But the trouble is that race, whatever it is literally, has become a social construction. And it refers to very often not only to skin color, but as I say, it's looks and outlooks. There's an assumption that the way people look is related to the way they behave. That's not a new idea. It goes all the way back to the early taxonomists. But today, we very often see that. So you see someone who looks a particular way and you make certain assumptions, which gets back to the whole notion of prejudice, which is not only an attitude or a belief, but also a predisposition to act. You see somebody and you say, oh, I don't know if I trust that person. Why? Because they look a particular way. But in the basic sense of ethnicity, we're talking about culture. I once had a seminar when I talked about WASPs and other ethnics. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants are as much ethnic as Italian-Americans or African-Americans.
We're talking with Peter Rose. His new book is Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, we might assume that tensions are primarily between whites, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, as you're mentioning, and others. Yet there have been tensions between marginalized communities as well. Does this point out to a perceived continuum of other in our society?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that there was a period, to give you an example, when Puerto Ricans in New York identified themselves as Latinos or Hispanics, lest they be considered black, when many are indeed black and a mixture of black and indigenous native people, as well as Spanish. I think that it reverts back to that hierarchy. But I'm sorry, I lost the initial question again.
Yeah, I was just asking if this is if it points to a perceived continuum of other in our society. We think of it as whites and others, but there has been this, you know, tension between marginalized communities. Well, yeah.
Yes, and there. I mean, look at the Miami today between Cubans and African Americans, those of Cuban background and so forth. Yeah, I think that that's back to the rivalry, back to the tribalism, back to the strength of community on the one hand. I think that one of the things I didn't mention earlier is ethnic groups have been very important in terms of mobility for Americans. You help your own to get ahead, but sometimes you do that at the expense of others, and others who are competing for the same small piece of turf, for example. The workers' rivalry, and it gets back to the white versus non-white an affirmative action issue.
In our country, we haven't had success addressing our racial and ethnic diversity. You know, should immigrants assimilate? And if we expect assimilation, what does it mean to be American? Should we blend cultures and continue to redefine what it means to be American? So talk a little bit how we've struggled with these issues.
Well, we've done that ever since the founding of the country. And as I discuss in the book, there are various paths that have been suggested. And one of them, you use the word assimilation. That is, if you could become like me, then maybe I'll accept you. That's assimilation, sort of a one-way process. There's also a more romantic notion of amalgamation, that we'll all blend in the one thing called the American. And the third one is a kind of accommodation, or what I call viable pluralism. I think the fact of the matter is, and these are sort of theoretical or heuristic devices that are used to sort of set up paths to integration, if you will. But I think, in fact, all three things have happened in the United States. There's been a tremendous amount of assimilation. Look at our language, look at our laws, and so forth. Mm-hmm. There's also been a great deal of amalgamation. We are, and when you think of what are the favorite foods of American people across the board in short order places, I think of pizzas and bagels and so forth. Well, those are ethnically specific, but no longer. But the third thing is that I think that the viable pluralism is very important. To say that I am an African American or a Chinese American means that you're not denigrating your past, but you're hooking it. It's hyphens connecting, as John Dewey said, not separating. I think too often the hyphens separate. Now, this does not gainsay the fact that ethnicity, as I said earlier, can be used in times of stress as a refuge, and you get retribalization. You get rivalries based upon this. But with all, I think that it sounds like that we've made no progress. I think we've made tremendous progress. We've just had some terrific setbacks recently in terms of the pluralism of this society. I think we're dealing with the dilemmas of our diversity, but it is a very diverse society. And when things go bad, and especially when they're led by somebody who knows how to exploit them, then we revert to a much more polarized society. And polarized particularism, it's very frightening.
Many people didn't think Donald Trump was savvy politically, yet he was able to capitalize on anti-immigrant nativism and anxiety in working-class white voters. Talk about this as a political strategy and the opportunities that Democrats missed to speak to this group of voters back in 2016.
Well, I think it's the fourth chapter, I talk about exploiting the angst of the white working class. And I think that they really missed the boat, the Democratic Party, and particularly Hillary Clinton, not least by calling people deplorables. But they missed the cultural, economic, educational divides that do exist in our society, regional divides, local versus cosmopolitan. There were people who understood it. Bernie Sanders understood it. Michael Moore understood it, and said we've got to address these issues as well. This doesn't mean that I'm not suggesting that. Let me put it differently. I don't think all these people are bigots, but I think that they are very easily and were very easily led to believe that many of their problems, the dislocation of industry and so forth, was blamed, something that they could blame on somebody else. There were many things that were happening in the in recent years that led to the anxiety that was felt, and it was readily exploited. And I think that Donald Trump is a very ignorant man in many ways, but I think that he's a very clever manipulator, and the people around him were able to sort of reinstate the kind of nativist appeal, the kind of nationalism, and the blaming of others for what was happening to them. We know that education is a very critical divide. People with high school diplomas and above, people without it, or people with college degrees and those who don't have it. People who live their whole lives in small rural towns and never see other people, as opposed to those who are out in a wider world. This doesn't mean that there isn't prejudice in the cities and so forth. There is, of course. But I really think that there's a concatenation of variables that were missed in that time. And I think they were better understood in this last election, and that's why states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and so forth, the Democrats were more successful because they began to address those very issues that you were.
So the political slogans that Trump used, Make America Great Again, America mm-hmm. First, speak to that, what you're talking about, that nativism and populist nationalism, right?
Yeah, well, those terms are direct reversions to the 1930s, to Lindbergh and other American nationalists, or what we call nativists. And they appealed then, and fortunately, in a perverse kind of way, the war stopped that, and then we all joined forces, supposedly. I mean, we didn't, but it did help to tamp down the nationalism of the nativism, with a more unified nationalism.
Many people refer to
appeal to patriotism. Pardon me.
Yeah. I didn't know you were finished. I'm sorry.
Many people. Phone. That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Many people refer to Trump's rhetoric as telling it like it is, or as a refreshing alternative to PC or politically correct speech.
I'm sorry, I just plugged the phone in.
Many people refer to Trump's rhetoric as telling it like it is, or as refreshing a refreshing alternative to PC or politically correct speech. And it's easy to write this off as people simply agreeing with Trump's views on social or political issues. But if we dig deeper, is there something more we can learn here?
Well, I think that telling it like it is. is a funny term. What we can learn is to be very wary, it seems to me, of those who so readily exploit the kinds of things we were talking about before, and to counter them with some hard facts. For example, I mentioned in passing that the changes in industry. People have to be re-educated to a new technological society, to new technologies and so forth, helping them. But instead of that you blame everybody else for what's going on.
So those who dislike President Trump often view Trump supporters as extensions of Trump himself. For example, if they think Trump is racist, then they believe his supporters are racist, too. Tell us about the danger in this way of thinking.
Well, I don't believe that all his supporters are racist, but I think that what he does is give them license to express their antipathy or give them targets on whom to blame for their problems, and it becomes sort of a vicious circle. The people then react, and they say, "You see, that's the way they are." We're seeing that right now in the streets of Washington just today.
We're talking with Peter Rose. His new book is Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Peter Rose, Sophia Smith Professor Emeritus, and Senior Fellow of the Kahn Institute at Smith College. He's also a visiting scholar at the Institute for Research in the Social Sciences at Stanford University. And his new book out this month is Tropes of Tolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Peter, propaganda has long been a tool to spread messages of hatred, bigotry, and racism. And in the book, you include many disturbing images. Some are posters, some are flyers, some are cartoons, including, this really surprised me, Theodore Gisele, also known as Dr. Seuss. Describe that cartoon.
Yeah, that cartoon was done in 1942. It's a portrait of caricatured Japanese or Asian-looking people marching down the coast of California to pick up some TNT from a guy that looks like them. It's obviously an appeal to people to beware of the fifth column that supposedly Japanese or Japanese Americans the threat that they had. Ted Geisel, who did that cartoon and was already using the name Dr. Zeus, had done some pretty racist caricatures when he was at Dartmouth, and then worked for, I think it was for the Office of War Information. I'm not sure when he did some of those cartoons during the war. I cite that because you can see how easily it is to portray the enemy in grotesque caricature. And I mention in that, I should say parenthetically, that after the war, he either realized or was admonished and corrected and apologized for many of the things that he had done. And he later did a absolutely wonderful book that many of your listeners must know called The Sneetches, which is really a send-up of race relations about the Sneetches, those that have stars in their bellies and those that don't and the others want it and so forth. And it gets back to what I talked about in reference groups and who's good and who do you want to be like. But one of the things that I mentioned in that first chapter where I cite that, and I also, there's a drawing that I drew when I was an eight-year-old kid in 1941, in 1941, there's a caricature of a buck-toothed, slant-eyed, ugly-looking enemy. We call them the Jap. Mm-hmm. And I learned to draw that in my class, in the third grade or whatever grade it was, by my art teacher. That's what we did. I mentioned that we still do that. And I have a photograph of a poster of a bandido with a sombrero and a turned-down mustachio put out by the National Socialist, the American Nazi Party, which does exactly the same sort of thing that Zeus was doing or Ted Geisel was doing and others during the war, making fun, making caricatures, exaggerating characteristics, and stigmatizing. And it gets back to what we talked about earlier, of scapegoating, stigmatizing, right, labeling, and all those things to show who's different, who is the other, the word you used earlier.
Yeah. Social media is now the preferred platform to disseminate propaganda, false information, and conspiracy theories. And we can talk for a long time about the dangers of social media, but do you see opportunities to use social media as a platform to counteract propaganda?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed message, though. You know, what we can use for good, it can also be used for bad or for evil. And we're seeing this in spades of late. Absolutely.
So although the Trump presidency will conclude in a matter of weeks, more than 70 million Americans voted for him in November and continue to support him. Do you think President Trump will continue to be an influence on American politics and society once he leaves office?
I don't know if he will, but I think that the Trumpism will, or the ideology, it's going to take a lot to get us back on track and away from the kind of nativism that has been so much a part of his era, of his politics. I think right now he's in a lot of trouble himself, and I don't think that the recent behavior is helping him. But I do think that there is a movement in this country that is very frightening, that is based on this politics of fear. And as I said, we're seeing it today in Washington. I have, my hope is that there will be that it will unravel, but I'm not holding my breath right now.
What are the opportunities that President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris have to address the anxiety and fear revealed and exploited by Donald Trump?
First of all, a calmness that they have. I think a healing proclivity that I think both have. I happen to feel that Biden was the right choice at the right time, even though I'm more sympathetic, to some of the positions of Bernie Sanders and some of the others who are more progressive. I think that we need a period of healing now. And I also think that these are people who understand the workings of government in a way that I don't think Donald Trump ever studied, knew, and certainly didn't use, except as a device for making deals and so forth, transactions. So in that sense, I think we're in a good position. And if things go well today, you know, with Ossoff, that's going to make a tremendous difference if the Congress is in Democrat hands, and especially the Senate now. Because without that, I think much new legislation can be blocked, as it has been, as it was during the Obama administration. We can rely less on executive orders and so forth and more on the will of the people collectively. I also think that there's going to be a split in the Republican Party. I think it's already evident between the Trumplicans, as Chris Cuomo calls them, and the Trumplicans, I guess he calls them, and the more traditional Republicans. I think that the Lincoln Project will become stronger. Now, whether there'll be a new party, I don't know. But I am, as I say, cautiously optimistic, but I worry that what has been wrought is going to be hard to, the genie is out of the bottle, in a sense, yeah, in terms of the politics sphere that I talk about.
For generations, the threat to American democracy was seen as coming from outside our borders. Could it be that we are the biggest threat to our democracy?
I think so in many ways. I think that the divisions that I said in the beginning of this interview are very profound and have been exploited, and I worry about that. We've seen this even in Trump. In the beginning, it was the outsiders, it was the Mexicans, it was the Muslims who were going to take over, and now it's the threat from within. We can't trust each other. We can't. It's classic in a way, and a reversion. Tom Snyder talks about, others talk about it, of this fascist mentality, proclivity, if you will, among certain leaders who know how to get under the skin or into the minds of people who are a bit at sea, looking for leadership, looking for the man on the white horse. And we saw it. We saw it. I mean, 70 million, you're absolutely right. These people aren't all Nazis. But they sure march in lockstep with many people who are neo-Nazis.
Do you believe democracy as a political system can survive if democratic values are not upheld within the society?
No, you have to. The trust is a very, you know, the two words that keep coming up in my mind and when I was writing the book are fear and trust. And I think that trust is terribly important in a system like our own. And as trust is eroded and fear is exploited, we weaken the whole democratic system. My feeling, however, right now is that we're at a threshold, and it seems to me that, although, again, I don't want to be overly optimistic, that the good guys are winning. It's been very tough. And people who are sensitive, Warnock this morning, I thought when he spoke, sensitive to all the people. Biden, I think, is, while some people on the far reaches of the Democratic Party don't like it, I think Biden talking about binding the wounds is very important, perhaps even Lincoln-esque. I think that that's what we've got to do. We've got to stress that this is one nation, many people, but one nation.
Yeah, it's as you're saying, it's going to take time. And I think when we look back in history, you know, we've gone through some rocky spots before. And you said you don't want to be too optimistic, but no. Are you optimistic? What are your thoughts?
I'm guardedly optimistic. No, I think that the center will hold. I think the center's been hollowed out, and I think it's coming back together. And I think that people like Biden and Kamala Harris and so forth do represent a center left, if you will, that is very important for us politically as a nation. Does it go as far as I would like to go in terms of such things as, let's say, health care? I can't think of another modern industrial nation that doesn't have a national health system, and I'd like to see it here. But I think we're moving in the right direction, and I think that they will move us in the right direction. I also think that in some ways the Trump people are overplaying their hands. I think that the debacle that's going on in Congress right today, that will be with Ted Cruz and others, may backfire, and I think it's already starting to fragment. But again, I don't want to say that it's over, because 70 million people, as you indicated, did follow Trump, and I think that maybe they'll lose 20 million, but they'll still have 50 million. It's guardedly optimistic.
It's a lot of people. Now, you include a number of prophetic and insightful quotes from a variety of leaders and scholars in the book. Is there a particular quote or sentiment that you'd like to leave us with?
I would. Very quickly, I want to just say four different things. In the epigraph, in the opening of the book, I have three quotes. And I'd like to just repeat them here.
Oh, yes, please.
The first is from Machiavelli, and it says, "Politics have no relation to morals." And the second is, "If you tell a lie often enough, it becomes the truth." And that's Joseph Goebbels. And that's what we've been seeing. And the last one is literally said by Donald Trump on several occasions, "Real power is," he said, "I don't even want to use the word, fear." And I would say that all of that is related to a statement by a man I admire tremendously, whose picture hangs over my desk for the last 50 years, Justice Louis Brandeis. And Brandeis said, "Fear breeds repression. Repression breeds hate. And hate menaces stable government." And I think we've just seen a playback of that in the last couple of years. And if there was another quote that relating to this issue of fear, is to remember what FDR said, and that is that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And I think we've got to get over that. We've got to get over fearing everything. I ended the book by saying that I hope that someday I can write a sequel, and someday soon, because I'm very old, that it can be not tropes of intolerance, politics, pride, prejudice, and the politics of fear, but it can be tolerance and trust in a renewed America. Tolerance and trust. These are two things that I think are so important. Tolerance, not in the sense of putting up with, but tolerance in experiencing what other people think and accepting it, and trust in terms of our fellow citizens, our fellow man. I think those are the things that are so important to me if we're going to get back on track. And getting back on track is really where I would end, because I think we were on track. We were moving in the right direction. It's up and down. It's been two steps forward, one step back, but it has been two steps forward. And I think recently we've taken two or three steps back.
Peter Rose's latest book, just out this month, is titled Tropes of Intolerance, Pride, Prejudice, and the Politics of Fear. We'll post a link with more information about Peter and his book at our website, capeandislands.org. Peter Rose, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Mindy. It's good talking to you. Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.